this hour.
Black and white.
The greatness of a nation, the greatness of its people, is not defined by its size, the weapons it possesses, the money held in international banks, or the skyscrapers it boasts.
Dineros depositados en la banca internacional, ni por los rascacielos.
Instead, it's determined by the resolve of its people to pursue a fair policy that benefits themselves and all of humanity, and to stand in solidarity with those fighting for sovereignty and independence. This is exemplified by Yemen and its people, who teaches daily what it means to support a nation that is being attacked, massacred, and starved, much like the Palestinian people. The Yemenis have embraced the Palestinian cause as their own, bearing the consequences of this stance, as the imperialists and Zionists do not remain passive.
No se quedan impávidos. Por el contrario.
On the contrary, they bomb various ports in Yemen and commit acts of murder. Nevertheless, Yemen does not kneel. It responds decisively and effectively against Israeli territory, targeting airports, ports, and even U.S. and British aircraft carriers and other ships in the Red Sea. Yemen prevents any cargo intended for the Zionist entity from passing through its waters. They have sunk ships. So what greater demonstration of solidarity exists today for the peace on earth? Who can show greater solidarity than this?
¿Quién puede mostrar mayor solidaridad que esa que un pueblo no muy numeroso?
A small community, not particularly wealthy and facing significant challenges in life, is nonetheless capable of feeling the pain of others, embracing it as their own and making the struggles of others their own cause. To speak of Yemen today is to speak of the awareness of solidarity that exists in the world, as these are not mere polite statements or temporary declarations. They are tangible actions that involve their own blood, their own lives. This is surely something that the youth and communities around the world must be embracing. Look at that small country, that not-so-numerous population, brave as they come, unlike any other at this moment.
Valiente como el que más, como ningún otro, en este instante, que nos muestra de que es posible.
Showing us that it is possible and necessary to stand up against the great imperialist powers, against the entire collective West, against the Zionist entity, to prevent them from carrying out their massacres of the peoples.
Su injerencia sobre los mismos y al mismo tiempo vencer. Eso es el Yemen.
Their interference in their affairs, and at the same time, to triumph. That is Yemen. It is struggle, solidarity, the determination to win, and the commitment to bring about the changes our times demand. The mainstream media can say whatever it wants, can make a fool of itself as always, talking about a people in rags from the desert, who have nothing to eat, yet they get involved in other people's conflicts, because it's not happening to them. They're not Palestinians, and since they're not Palestinians, they shouldn't be involved. However, they build their weapons and use them against a common enemy. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. ¿Qué es el Yemen? ¿Qué fuerza tiene ese pueblo?
What is Yemen? What strength do these people possess to constantly confront Western powers and the Zionist entity? They embarrass them, attacking their destroyers and aircraft carriers, making some flee at times, striking at the heart of the Zionist entity that occupies Palestinian lands. Where does this strength come from? What is the role, How can a country and a people like that make a series of puppet Arab governments blush with shame, unable to show solidarity and stand by Palestine? Today we will discuss this here on Black and White with Nicola Hadwa from the city of Valparaiso, an international analyst responsible for international relations at the Chilean Committee for Solidarity with Palestine. Welcome to our program, Black and White, Nicola Hadwa.
It's a pleasure, Eduardo, an honor and a joy to be part of such an important and interesting program like yours. So I'm here at your complete disposal.
Nicola, in the introduction, I raised the question of where that ability, that passion, that strength, and that courage of the Yemenis comes from, which the dominant Western media often portrays as desert terrorists.
Of course, every enemy of the empire, Eduardo, every foe of Zionism has to deal with their vast misinformation capabilities, which they control. To give you an idea, they manage 52,000 multinational corporations, and within those, they oversee hundreds in the information sector, but in this instance, it pertains to misinformation. We need to get used to the fact, Eduardo, that whatever comes from the West, to illustrate it better, out of every 10 words, 15 are lies. Therefore, reading the Western press is not only pointless, but also a way to poison oneself and become misinformed. The Yemeni people are a historic nation recognized throughout history for being an indomitable people, never humiliated, never defeated. Their sense of national dignity and their concept of a struggle are deeply rooted in the popular masses. You see, there was an aggression, which we can discuss later, from the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and the criminal Israeli entity that commits infanticide, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, supported by Egypt and Sudan, against the poorest Arab country, and yet they could not defeat it and had to leave in disgrace. So we're facing the poorest country in the Arab world, yet it stands out as the most dignified among a region filled with feudal monarchies and treacherous regimes. Yemen and Algeria are currently holding their heads high for the dignity of the Arab peoples, which includes all Arab and Islamic nations, and we must also acknowledge the heroic stance taken by the people and government of Iran.
Nicola, what could we say about the role that the people of Yemen have played, not just ideologically and politically, but in shaking the consciousness of the entire Arab and Muslim world? What specific role have they had in striking against the targets of the Zionist entity and those who collaborate with them, including the United States itself?
Well, Eduardo, the role that Yemen has played is truly impressive. It's remarkable because that country, which seemed unknown to the West and to the popular masses in the West, suddenly emerges on the global geopolitical and geostrategic map as a nation of tremendous significance. The United States goes in with two aircraft carriers, the largest, most complex, and modern ones, along with eight destroyers and frigates, to threaten and attack Yemen in order to assist in protecting the criminal, child-killing entity that is Israel. Notice that, shortly after, one of the aircraft carriers suffered a severe blow, while the other took a moderate hit. Some ships were hit by missiles and had to quickly leave the Arabian Sea and exit the Red Sea, because they realized that Yemen's weapons can reach them. Weapons that, by the way, they built with their own hands. On the other hand, Yemen created a very important maritime blockade, a blockade in the Arabian Sea, in the Gulf of Aden, and in the Red Sea, against the criminal child-killing Zionist entity. This blockade was quite effective, but unfortunately, through land routes, the treacherous feudal monarchies and the Arab collaborators, the reactionary Arabs, created a land corridor to supply the Zionist child-killing entity with the necessary products. Indeed, Yemen was and still is by far the strongest, most determined and best ally, as well as the most effective ally that the Palestinian people have had.
Let's take a break and continue right away, Nicola. Thank you very much. We're back here with Nicola Hadwa for a powerful interview about this incredible country and its wonderful people called Yemen. Nicola, you were discussing how it has humiliated the collective West, as we might say, and they have been forced to take measures to transport their products through alternative routes, which also means higher costs. That's already a victory, by the way. Please continue with what you were saying.
Por favor, continúa en lo que estabas relatando.
Bueno, sí. Yemen logró imponer una ecuación nueva.
Well, yes. Yemen managed to establish a new equation and show that the Israeli child-killing entity was not an invincible army. It was, in fact, a considerably weaker army and country. Unfortunately, those who do the dirty work for this criminal entity are the Arab reactionaries. When Syria, supported by Iraqi militias, was about to enter and open the front to the Golan Heights, the feudal monarchies, along with the Turkish traitors, took it upon themselves to overthrow the Syrian government to prevent them from opening the front to the Golan Heights against Israel. When Hezbollah was delivering a massive beating to the Zionists in southern Lebanon, remember that on the first day of the attack, Eduardo, the first day the criminal Zionist entity attempted to enter Lebanon, it lost 30% of its attacking force and failed to advance even 10 meters. I mean, we need to know that the defeat inflicted by Hezbollah was at such a level. Well, then the Arab reactionaries, with a pro-colonial government, which we could say is recolonized and closely allied with imperialism, threatened Hezbollah with a civil war if they did not agree to a ceasefire with the criminal regime of Israel. In the case of the Palestinians, when the front in Jordan was about to open, the Palestinian National Authority, along with the Zionist agents, mainly Mahmoud Abbas, took it upon themselves to suppress the Palestinian people, the resistance battalions located in Tulkarem, Nablus, and Jenin, arresting many and handing them over to the Israeli child-killing regime. In other words, the Arabs and the Arab reactionaries, they have been the ones doing the dirty work for the Israeli criminal entity. In the case of Yemen, the empire tasked Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates with trying to suffocate Yemen in an operation that involved British, French, and American troops, along with the entire Saudi military and the forces of the worst traitors in the Arab world, the United Arab Emirates, who managed to occupy the province of Ma'arib in Yemen. The province of Ma'arib is home to all of Yemen's oil and gas reserves, aiming to cripple its economy. Nevertheless, Yemen stood firm, defeating the occupying forces, overcoming Saudi Arabia and pushing out many of the imperial British and French soldiers. The Yemeni people are impoverished, I must reiterate, but they are fierce fighters who do not know the meaning of defeat or surrender.
Ni conocen la palabra rendición,
Eduardo. Así es. Nicola, algunos analistas dicen...
Indeed, Nicola, some analysts suggest that there is an exodus of settlers fleeing from the occupied Palestine, citing one of the reasons as the ongoing and persistent missiles and drones coming from Yemen that keep them in a state of anxiety and alertness. In fact, in an analysis I read, it mentioned that the shrapnel that sometimes falls even on the beach prevents them from enjoying their summer, from being by the sea, basking in the sun, and they have to leave because the shrapnel falls around them, which puts them in a state of nervousness and fear. What do you think about the significance of these bombings that may seem small and insignificant, yet are constant?
Throughout the ongoing war, aside from the bravery displayed by the Palestinian resistance, which has notably dealt significant blows to the Israeli occupying army in Gaza, consider that they have been fighting for 2 years without being able to defeat the Palestinian resistance. Zionist military analysts claim that the strength of the resistance is only growing. It's worth mentioning that the actions of the Zionist regime mirror those of the Nazis, who, when their soldiers faced defeat, turned to attack the civilian population. What actions is the Zionist regime taking? This regime cannot exist in peace, nor can it thrive in war. Yemen, with its meticulously calculated, well-defined, and carefully planned attacks, has contributed significantly alongside the Palestinian resistance. This is crucial, and I will elaborate a bit more. The fact is that 1.5 million people have emigrated from the occupied territories, and the majority, over 70%, are young individuals who refuse to join the army. They have come to realize that this war is not going to end soon. They understand that they are as vulnerable as the innocent Palestinian civilians. For instance, you can observe that currently 2 or 3 fighters arrive daily from Tel Aviv to Buenos Aires, bringing along the Zionist child killers. This war has uprooted, as I mentioned, 1.5 million occupiers, but what are the implications of this? Not only the fear and the evacuation of occupants from Palestine, which has led the United States and European powers to speak up and reveal their concerns, but we could also say that there is a rapid recognition of the Palestinian state. However, this is aimed at saving the Zionist regime from a definitive and total collapse. Why? 66,000 businesses have gone bankrupt. There are no workers, and the evangelical zealots who are used as cannon fodder to fight against their own Christian brothers have not been enough to get the productive machine running. The banking system is paralyzed, commerce is at a standstill. They cannot meet their international commitments, and they are unable to fix the economy. The most optimistic say that this criminal entity, Israel, could recover in 10 years. The number of Jews coming to Israel have dropped to zero. Consequently, the Israeli regime is becoming completely unviable. On one hand, the Israeli occupiers have realized that their regime was serving transnational corporations and American imperialism rather than their own people, who spoke of a Jewish land meant only for the Jews. Well, they came to understand that they were sending their young men to die. They let them perish and even killed themselves. I mean, whenever they had the chance to eliminate an Israeli captive at the hands of the Hamas fighters, they did so. When an Israeli soldier is captured, the Air Force goes in and bombs the area to kill that soldier, and also the members of the Palestinian resistance. Thus, they have recognized that the regime does not care about the Jewish people or the so-called Jewish land at all. What truly matters to them is the interests of transnational corporations and supporting American imperialism.
Nicola, tu pusiste un punto muy importante al inicio.
You made a very important point at the beginning just now. You mentioned that the movement seen in various European countries to recognize and establish a Palestinian state is either a salvation or an attempt to preserve the occupying Zionist entity. Please elaborate a bit more on that, as it is quite significant.
Of course, that's the most important thing. Right now, the United States and NATO, having seen all their plans fail, are moving on to another plan, hoping the Arabs will do the dirty work for the Israeli criminal entity. There is talk of quickly recognizing the Palestinian state. The Palestinian National Authority is not just some treacherous collaborators. In fact, the Palestinian Authority is like a second Israel. Those collaborators would be responsible for managing Gaza and the West Bank. Here, the criminal Israel has become divided. The majority does not want the Palestinian Authority to govern either Gaza or the West Bank, and the parliament has agreed to annex all of the West Bank. Therefore, this plan could fail just like the French plans of Charles de Gaulle,
which were undermined by the most reactionary elements in Algeria, namely the OAS. So in this case, once this figurative state is created and accepted, which would have no army whose economy is intertwined with Israel and which lacks clear borders, it is ultimately a foolish idea that only the United States and Israel could conceive. Once the Palestinian Authority wishes to enter Gaza, then the Arab League would be responsible for forming an army, supported by the Zionist army, equipped to enter Gaza and defeat the resistance that the United States, France, and the United Kingdom, with their child-killing Zionist army, have been unable to overcome, as they have all been defeated. I mention this because there are American, French, and British border soldiers, official troops who are there and have died, and among them, more than 50 Americans have lost their lives.
Nada más que norteamericanos han muerto más de 50.
Así es, Nicola. Bueno, el tiempo aquí es brutal.
That's right, Nicola. I really appreciate your remarks, and it's clear how important the struggle of the Yemeni people is, along with their courageous attitude and a solidarity towards the Palestinian people, serving as an example for all countries that claim to be sovereign. Thank you so much, Nicola, for being with us here on Black and White.
Thanks. It's a pleasure and honor for me to be part of such a great program that you host, Eduardo. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you back in the studio, shedding light on some of the questions and answers here related to the Islamic laws according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And we are supposed to actually, talk about some of these laws, of miscellaneous nature, of course. Let me begin this episode with this question. If at the time of the last tashahhud of the imam, the prayer leader, basically,
yes,
the congregant is in the first or third rak'ah, is tajafi obligatory? What should we say while translating?
Well, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Tajafi, meaning resting on the toes with knees raised while leaning to the right. Resting on the toes with knees raised and leaning to the right a little bit is not obligatory during the tashahud of the imam. When the imam is busy doing tashahud or even going completing the namaz, it's not necessary for the person joining or attending the congregational prayer to be seated in that position, in the position of tajafi. Rather, the follower should maybe rise and continue his prayer to complete the remaining rak'ah. And of course, the religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may he live long, says that it is recommended, it is mustahab, to remain seated in the position of tajafi While the Imam is reciting the tashahhud, it is recommended. And in this case, the follower should recite the tashahhud along with the Imam. Okay, he can recite the tashahhud along with the Imam, but he is not required to recite the salam, okay, because otherwise it will complete
end
the prayer.
Yes.
So this way, the spiritual etiquette of following the Imam is observed without, you know, disrupting the order of the individual's prayer. The individual's prayer is maintained, and the shape of the prayer, the form of the prayer is observed.
Mm-hmm. Does it have to be like in that special position that you described? Like, I've seen it actually, many congregants do this in the first or third rak'ah while they are offering their prayer. And the Imam is, in fact, on the tashahhud, basically, right? So they would, stay in a very special position, something similar to a squatting situation, basically. So is that recommended?
It is recommended.
Uh-huh.
It is recommended.
I see.
Yes, that is the position. You just put, rest on the toes, and your knees are not touching the ground.
Yes, they're a little bit high above the ground, right?
Yes.
So if they, assume the position of the tashahhud, would it be wrong?
It's not wrong. It's not, it does not affect the prayer.
Uh-huh.
Yes, he will have to wait until, the imam, if the imam is going to give salam, he's not going to say salam, okay?
Of course.
Yes, he will have to stand up.
They could continue the prayer.
Yes.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Chawid. Let's, take a break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, some people are not able actually to perform Hajj due to any good reason. For example, physical incapability, basically, right? The question that was raised in that regard is like, my mother, somebody asked, has performed Hajj on behalf of my grandmother. Does this Hajj on behalf replace the obligatory Hajj of my mother? Or must she perform Hajj again for herself when she's able to do so?
Right. Oh, I think the answer is very clear. When someone is not capable of performing the obligatory Hajj because of certain reasons, and mainly because of financial issues, problems, and she or maybe he or someone, anyone, wants to represent another person, that person is supposed to give provide for the expenses of the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, she or he can perform Hajj on behalf of anyone, maybe the mother, the grandmother, or anyone else, anyone. So it's okay. But if the individual himself has the means and the wealth, the ability to perform Hajj, she cannot represent another person. She must perform Hajj on her own behalf. And I mean, she must perform her own Hajj, which is wajib on her, and then after she does it, of course, in the following years, she can take action to perform Hajj on behalf of anyone, including the grandmother or the grandfather, anyone else. So the question I think, I suppose, you asked is, of course, it depends on whether she is financially and bodily capable or not. If she is, she must perform Hajj after she... Okay, maybe in the time when she performed Hajj on behalf of her grandmother, right?
Mm-hmm.
She was not financially capable to perform her own Hajj. But later on, maybe after a few years, she started to create or build some kind of asset. And then she found herself in a position to go to Hajj. Of course, she must take action for Hajj because she is now
capable.
Capable, yes.
Yes. But can anyone, in fact, or any individual, have both intentions?
No.
Like, for example, you do like your own obligatory Hajj if you are capable to do it, of course, or you have enough assets as you just mentioned, along with the Hajj on behalf.
No, it's not permissible to do any act of worship, whether it's prayer, whether it's Hajj, or whether it's fasting, to perform a single duty, religious duty, on behalf
with two intentions.
Yeah, with two intentions. Yes, that's not permissible.
Uh-huh.
Yes, you cannot do it.
Uh-huh, I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's have a break, another break, and then we'll come back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, somebody asked us, I went out of town for recreation, for fun.
Yes.
I found a ring on the way and picked it up. So what is his or her duty?
Right. The ruling depends on the value of the item he found, okay, depending on how much valuable it is. So the situation differs from time to time, depending on the value of the item found, right? If the value of the ring is less than the price of 2.5 grams of silver, then he must keep it. And of course, he can keep it. He may keep it.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes his
property,
yes. And there's no need for going around and announcing, because it's not worth announcing. It's 2.5 grams of silver, right? So it's very important because normally we, for example, walk along the street and all of a sudden we find something, okay? Something. So we have to see whether it is really worth 2.5 grams or more than that. If it's more than that, then the ruling and it differs. Otherwise, you can pick it up for yourself and use it. Okay. Then, if the value is more than that amount, I would like to make it clear, then he is required to announce it publicly for 1 year.
Oh.
1 year. This is the most difficult part of the obligation, because if you have to announce it for 1 year, keep announcing it, make it wherever possible, whether on the cyberspace or in public places.
In the press. Yes.
Make announcement. It's necessary for her to do. Otherwise, he cannot take it or use it for himself or give it to someone else on behalf of the...
As a charity.
As charity on behalf of the actual owner.
Yes.
So, okay. If the owner turns up and claims it, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
He can, after he gives the signs, and actually he can give it
back.
Okay, back
return
to him.
The property, yes.
But if after one year no owner claims it and comes forward to ask for, then of course he can keep it for himself. He can give it in charity on behalf of the owner, or he can keep it with himself while still searching for the owner. This is the third choice.
A very quick question. We don't have much time, Shostovi. If quite related to this question, of course. If, you know, well, we just ignore it and we don't pick it up.
Right.
Would it be actually an ethical and religious duty, basically?
I think it is safer. It is safer to not to pick it up.
Uh-huh.
Yes, because you know.
Is it okay? Is it permissible to do it?
Why not?
Like to give it a shot.
You know, for example, you okay? I should also mention this. Depending on whether you are in whether you live in an Islamic country or in a non-Islamic country, so that ruling also differs. Okay.
Mm.
If you find something in an Islamic country, you can choose not to pick it up.
Right.
Pick it up. Because if you pick it up, there's the headache comes after it.
Yes.
You will have to announce it. And, but if you are in a non-Muslim country and there's nothing to indicate that thing which you have found belongs to a Muslim, you can pick it for yourself. Even if it belongs you can pick it and use it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You just even if it's more than 2.5 grams.
I see. Thank you very much, Shostovi.
Yeah.
Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and Shostovi, our guest speaker. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is a wake-up call. Never again, never again means never again for all. To all my people in Gaza, even though we're living far from each other, your pain is my own pain. All for one new, one for all. Free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free, free Palestine. Choice better be on the right side of history. No one can be free till we all are free.
Yeah.
Enough is enough.
Enough. We gotta stop this genocide.
Free, free Palestine.
Steve.
Fabian Zulig, the Chief Executive Officer of the European Policy Centre, based here in Brussels, one of the most prestigious think tanks in the EU. Thank you very much for your time. I know you're a very busy man with a big team. In relation to the State of the Union 2025 address this week from the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, it was the first time we've heard her speak tough about Israel. And she talked about the possibility of sanctions against ministers and so on, and suspending parts of the trade agreement. Why do you think her stance on this subject has changed?
Well, there has been an accumulation of different things. Certainly, there has been a lot of pressure on her. But I think what is also very significant is that the opinion has been shifting at the domestic level. And in some of the big countries, the leaders were becoming more critical of Israel. So in a sense, she has tried to catch up with where the debate overall was at that moment in time. But of course, there are still big divisions within Europe. Different countries have very different takes. So she also acknowledged that some people will think she's not going far enough, and some people will think she's gone too far.
Why do you think it is that we do see so much division in the EU on the subject of Israel?
I think we have to look at two dimensions. I mean, firstly, it is normal that there are these divisions. We have 27 different countries which have very different foreign policy stances, and we shouldn't forget that foreign policy is not one of the main areas of European coordination. Every country has their own policy and has also differing opinions on particularly issues which are as intractable as the Middle East, where for a very long time there hasn't really been a convincing solution on the table. But the other element, and that also has to do with how the European Union is set up, even those countries which might agree with the Commission President or with other parts of the European institutions very often object to the European Union becoming involved in these discussions because they don't see that this is a role for the European level to have a foreign policy stance.
Yeah, but we see the EU is now preparing its 19th round of sanctions, tough sanctions against Russia, and yet no sanctions so far against Israel. Like, why do you think that is? Is it the argument that, you know, Ukraine is in Europe, or is it the fact some people talk about the very powerful Israel lobby that has an influence over the decisions that are taken here?
I would actually argue that Russia is the exception. It normally is difficult to get agreement between the member states when it comes to foreign policy issues. Just having seen, for example, the incursion into Polish airspace very much highlights that this is something which affects all of us. So in that area, it is much, much easier to get consensus to move forward. Yes, there will be one or two countries which object, one or two governments which object, because they always object. But in principle, there's a vast majority which supports that action. When it comes to Israel, when it comes to other parts of the world, there are far greater divisions. In part, that also has to do with history and the specific history of some countries with the countries involved. But more generally, it's just more difficult to get agreement, as we also see, for example, when it comes to China.
Well, the day before Ursula von der Leyen delivered the State of the Union address, there was a debate in the European Parliament on the situation in Gaza. And what you see there is a big chunk of the MEPs, the members of the European Parliament, the EU lawmakers, they are very far right. They support Netanyahu. They're very far right in their views. Why do you think it is that we're seeing the rise of the far right in the EU?
It is a long-term trend. We have seen the far right strengthening over time. In many ways, these are anti-parties. They don't really have solutions. They don't have programs. But they know what they are against, which is also a feature of how democratic discourse is developing. It's much easier now on social media to just simply be against certain issues and to get coalitions together which can block things. I think what we have seen in the United States is also a phenomenon over here, and we shouldn't underestimate how much the developments in the States will also fuel some of those divisions within Europe. Clearly, there are a number of far-right organizations which refer to Trump, which think that the Trumpian agenda is exactly what is needed. And I think we are going to see that it very much mixes with some of the big topics. I mean, clearly, migration has always been one of the breeding grounds for the far right. But we're also seeing increasingly it's about climate change and the measures which are there. It is about the war and supporting Ukraine, very often couched in terms of even if this is something which needs to be done, we shouldn't be the ones who are paying for it.
And Fabian, another thing that Ursula von der Leyen mentioned in her State of the Union address is in relation to the cost of living crisis. I mean, prices are so high here in the EU for rents, for food. You know, we've just seen a massive price increase over the last few years. Do you think, we mentioned the far right earlier, do you think that is why that could lead to a further expansion and rise of the far right?
I mean, certainly we live in much more challenging times. That's economically, that's socially. We are now in a period where for the first time really in European integration history, there's a realistic chance that the next generations are going to be worse off than current ones. And that creates a lot of political problems. In many areas, we now have to distribute costs. It's not about the benefits from working together, but it's actually about saying, how do we pay for defense? How do we pay for the green transition? How do we pay for all the different areas where we need to invest in the next few years? So it's a much more difficult political environment. And yes, many people are feeling that their life is getting worse, that they are not as secure, as stable, that they see prices rising. But the difficulty is that many of these are trends which are beyond the control of our governments or of the European Union. And the right-wing populists promise a lot, but there is no way they can fulfill these promises. And it's interesting, we've seen it with the example of Brexit, we've seen it now starting with the example of Trump. These promises do not lead to better outcomes for their population. In fact, they lead to worse outcomes, but it's very hard to counter them before they get into power.
Can I ask you as well about EU-US relations? Because obviously there's been a lot of tensions on issues like trade since Trump came back to the White House. How would you assess at the moment? There are differences on foreign policy. There are obviously issues in relation to trade, and what else could happen, we don't know. But how would you assess relations at the moment between the United States and the European Union?
Relations between, I would say, the White House and the European Union are very bad. In many ways, Trump is opposed to the concept of the European Union. He doesn't like multilateralism. He doesn't like cooperation between states. He believes in a world where power matters. And if you are stronger, you can do whatever you want. He doesn't care about allies. He cares about who he sees as important people. So it is about people like Putin, and it is about those who fawn over him, who suggest that he will get the Nobel Prize, and so on. So this is anathema to how Europe works. It is a real threat to our democracy, because of course there are influences of that on our debates, on our parties. But in the background is always this dependence of Europe on security as well. And that's why we also had to accept a deal, which is a very bad deal for Europe, but they were only bad choices on the table.
And when you say a bad deal for Europe, do you think that the European Commission, the institutions, the EU leaders could have pushed back harder against Trump on this issue?
Of course, we had the choice to push back harder. The question is, what would the consequences be of that? And we have already seen that Trump is very willing to put security on the table as well. And that is a risk which Europe at the moment cannot run because we are too dependent on the United States and Ukraine is too dependent on the United States. So what we had to accept in the end comes directly out of our weakness.
Can we afford more military spending in the European Union? We do have, if you look at the Eurostat data, we have a huge number of people at risk of poverty or in poverty. We've had, you know, increased spending in NATO, and most of the NATO members are also members of the EU in terms of the countries. And then additionally, more military spending within the EU itself. So billions upon billions being spent on weapons, and people argue not enough on social justice. So can we afford all this military spending?
I think we don't have a choice. There are imperatives which we have to fulfill, and defense has to be one of the key areas which we spend money on. And it is an area where also you will need a lot of public money. It is not something where you can rely on the private sector. But then I think it is also a question of seeing what is it actually we are spending on. There is a lot of money in the 5% target, which is also about infrastructure. It's about developing what will also help the private economy. It's not only about military. I would also argue that we can benefit a lot from this additional spending in the defense sector if we think about it in the right way, if we coordinate in Europe, if we don't buy all of these weapons from elsewhere. I think there are many things which we can do. But in the end, it's also not only about amounts of money. It's not about the figure which we are going to put in the end to convince Trump that we have done what we said we would do. It's about how well we are spending it. And I think this is the biggest challenge we have in Europe. When we look at how much we collectively spend, it is vastly more than Russia. But we are not very effective in how we spend it. So we need to find ways of getting better at spending that money, and that also means doing more things together. One of the big challenges, and I think that goes right through the State of the Union in almost every policy area, is that we now live in a world where the need to work together at the European level is greater than ever. Many of the challenges will not be addressed unless we do it together. But the political reluctance to really work together, to put competences at the European level, is greater than ever. So we have a paradox.
Can I ask you as well, you know, one of the big policy achievements of the European Union was to create the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA nuclear deal with Iran. And Trump in his first term tore that up. Now we don't know where we stand in terms of diplomacy and nuclear talks with Iran. Is there any hope of resurrecting the JCPOA in your opinion, or creating a new accord? What are your feelings, or what are your thoughts on that?
Certainly, the deal with Iran was groundbreaking, and it was very much Europeans in the driving seat, working out what could be done. But it was already very much damaged. After Trump tore it up in his first presidency. And now with the attacks on Iran by Israel, it's very hard to see also what the Iranian side is going to do. Clearly, there was a decision taken, I would argue, not only in Israel, but also in Washington, that military force would be more effective. Now it remains to be seen whether that's true, whether this has really damaged Iranian capabilities in the long run. It has increased the volatility, but we can't just go back to the old deal. That time has passed forever.
And in your view, could the EU side have done more to save the JCPOA nuclear accord? Could they be doing more now diplomatically in terms of trying to secure a new agreement?
It seems to be that at this moment in time, some of the key actors within the Middle East are entirely ignoring Europe. So if the United States, if Israel do not listen, it's very hard to see how Europe could play a broker role, because clearly you would have to have also concessions from those countries. So at the moment, I think it is very difficult to see any way forward, and I would actually argue that what we have seen over the last month is a significant deterioration in the Middle East, which will destabilize for a long time to come, because even long-standing issues like the two-state solution for Palestine is looking even further away than it did before.
Do you think there's any hope of a two-state solution at this stage?
At this stage, no. At this stage, there is no willingness to even start negotiating. But I would also say that all the actions which are being taken now are running counter to the idea of a two-state solution. So it's very hard to see how we will even return to the status quo before all of these attacks.
Yeah. And do you think that, like, even with the recent attack on Qatar, an independent sovereign state, and we saw the attack by Israel on Iran, and the United States also attacking Iran, but in terms of Israel's position, do you feel there's a move away from Israel and the EU, given that we've seen an escalation and attacks on sovereign countries? I know he has a lot, Benjamin Netanyahu and the government have a lot of support, for example, in the European Parliament with the far right. But generally speaking, at government level, EU institution level, is there a move away from Netanyahu?
I think what we've seen also in the reaction to the bombing in Qatar is that this is breaking the kind of guardrails which for many countries are just a step too far. Will that change his behavior? Well, that really depends on the big supporter. It depends on the United States. And there the question is whether, yes, we've seen a bit of condemnation, but whether that condemnation will actually be followed with concrete steps or whether it simply is talk. Unfortunately, my guess would be that Trump is not willing to do anything decisive, which means that Benjamin Netanyahu will just continue doing what he's doing.
More generally speaking, Fabian, can I ask you about what you see the future of the European Union being? I mean, the euro area is expanding shortly. In January, Bulgaria will join the euro. There are many countries that want to join the European Union, full stop, and they'll automatically join the euro in that case. But is there a danger that the EU could expand too quickly to bring in countries that might turn against the project in the long run, as we might have seen here at the moment, for example, perhaps with Hungary and a couple of others? So in terms of the future of the EU, what are your thoughts on that?
I think we should be very careful that we're not nostalgic about the European Union and what it might have been in the past. Because the reality is that we are seeing challenges also in the member states which were there from the beginning. What will happen, for example, if we have a far-right French president, which I would say is a very realistic possibility at this moment in